Whether you drive a car,
need a car,
or just occasionally bum a ride with friends,
you've come to the right place.
Join Jill and Tom as they break down everything that's going on in the auto world.
New car reviews,
shopping tips,
driving green,
electric cars,
classic cars,
and plenty of great guests.
This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast.
All right, this is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. I'm Tom Appel. Thank you. Thank you for joining us today. When you get a chance, check us out at consumerguide.com. All sorts of cool stuff there. My new car reviews, all sorts of fun classic car stuff and car history stuff. Plus, you can listen to the podcast right there on our homepage, though you really should subscribe. In studio with me is Jill Simonillo, contributing editor here at consumerguide.com. North American Car of the Year juror.
Juror.
I need to throw that syllable in there very deliberately or I lose it.
Juror.
I'm not a linguist.
No, you are not.
and she's a prolific freelancer.
Yes.
I made a mistake last week.
Which one?
Well, how many do you have?
I know you made one.
Okay. Maybe it's the same one.
Okay.
We'll talk about that in a moment. Right now, on the phone, Jim O'Brill, Communications Director for the Chicago Auto Show. Jim, how are you? You were on the floor of the show.
I am. Hi, Tom. Hi, Jill. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Good.
More importantly, how are you doing? I imagine you're busy.
I'm hanging in there. It's been a whirlwind of a few days here, kicking off with our media preview, rolling right into First Look for Charity, and rolling right into opening day. It's been a lot going on down here at McCormick Place, but all really positive energy here at the Chicago Auto Show this year.
It looks good. I'm enjoying the pictures. I've been following you guys on Facebook. Tell us about why people should go to the show. Some surprises, right? I saw that the Cadillac Celestiq, Cadillac's crazy nearly $400,000 custom EV, that's there.
Yeah, Cadillac didn't tell us that. That was a nice surprise.
Surprise!
I was walking the show during move-in, and all of a sudden I turned my head. I was like, oh, I didn't know that one was going to be here, but we're happy to have it. Also on the show floor is the Chevy Corvette CX concept, another one that they kind of kept from us until it arrived.
So that's cool.
People are flocking around that car. So definitely very cool to see that. Tesla has their robo-taxi concept.
I saw
here.
That.
So a couple wild ones. That's certainly a unique. I don't know how I'd feel about getting in one of those taxis, but you can certainly check it out here on the show floor.
That's the safest way to do that.
Well, you know what? The Cybercab is actually on Chicago streets right now testing. I was heading out to the, and this is the gold one, I was out on heading up to the suburbs on Friday for an appointment, and I was like, what in the Tesla is that? There was this gold thing on the road. It didn't have a rear window. It had these huge gold hubcaps. And I was like, what? And then you like drive around. All I saw was like that like 30-inch screen or whatever is on the dash. And I couldn't tell. It didn't have a steering wheel or foot pedals. But apparently, I get to the auto show and I saw it on the show floor. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's it. That's it. I saw that. And they were telling me that they have two or three models currently on the streets in Chicago testing with a human driver or human person sitting in the seat testing it. And I was like, I saw it.
What other surprises do you have for us?
There's a lot of new models on the show floor that I think a lot of people have not had the chance yet to see here in Chicago. Kia brought out the 2027 Telluride, which is just in dealerships now. Toyota's got the new RAV4 here. Honda's Prelude's on display. Subaru brought out their full line of new electric vehicles, including the Uncharted and the Trail Seeker, along with the new Outback. So there's a lot of new models on the show floor. But I have to tell you, the buzz that I'm seeing all over social media is our new Chi-Town Alley area.
Yes.
Cool.
So we created this new space really to celebrate car culture here in Chicago. And so we invited several car clubs, everything from exotics to Japanese import cars to lowriders to American Muscle with the Mustang Club. And then we had a contest where we selected six finalists to showcase their vehicles in the center circle. And the hype around this space has been incredible.
It's awesome.
Been very exciting because the energy, and it's a celebration. They're all together. They're all just true car fans. And then to kick it off this weekend, we had Sung Kang from the movie Drifter. He's got a new movie out. He was also in the Fast and Furious franchise. So he was here drawing huge crowds of people to the Chi-Town Alley space. So it's been really fun to see that come to life this year.
Well, that's really cool. Remind people what they need to know to come down and see you guys.
Yeah, the show's open now through President's Day, February 16th. Opens at 10 a.m. every day. You can buy your tickets at the gate, or you can buy them in advance online at chicagoautoshow.com. That's the easiest place to grab them. And then all the information for parking, what vehicles are at the show, and everything else, it's all at the website, chicagoautoshow.com.
Jim, sounds good. Good luck with the rest of the show.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate the time today.
All right, take care. That was Jim O'Brill with the Chicago Auto Show. What did I get wrong?
Now you're putting me on the spot, and I can't remember. It was an engine.
Yes.
Okay. It was the what did we talk about last week?
Outlander.
Yes. So it was the engine. You said it was that's it. Okay. You said it was the same engine as the Nissan Rogue, and it is not.
Yep. Brain fart. They're entirely different engines.
Yeah, and I meant to mention it at the end of the show, and brain fart on my end. I just didn't.
Always correct me. I don't want to be wrong. Yeah. So the Mitsubishi uses a 1.5 liter 4-cylinder.
Yep.
Turbocharged, 175 horse. The Rogue, though mechanically similar, uses a Nissan engine.
And it's I think it's also a 1.5 liter, but it's a 3-cylinder.
3-cylinder, and somehow more horsepower, like 200 horsepower.
Yes.
Actually, the Rogue feels downright quick.
Yeah.
So there you go. My bad. I apologize for the error.
Who corrected you?
Me.
Oh.
Like I woke up like, that's not right.
When you said it, I was like, I don't think
actually,
that's right.
When you said 4-cylinder, I'm like, that's not right, but it was right. But I didn't correct you.
I'm right. So back to the Chicago Auto Show for a hot minute.
Yeah.
I just want to say it's a smaller show, but it is a lot. It's cool. There's a lot of good stuff there. The one thing that Jim didn't mention that I think it's really cool to look at is the Corvette CX concept, which is
I wasn't aware that was there.
It is, and it was there yesterday, so it's there on public days, and it is really really cool. So I think that's definitely worth a look-see. That's I think one of the only concepts I saw on the show floor.
Well, that's pretty cool.
So, and then I do have to give a shout out to Ryder Lamb, who is participating in the Chi-Town Alley with his 1974-2002 BMW. And it's really cool. So if you're there, vote for that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, Chicago car culture, and cities are like this, right? LA has a very distinct culture, too, and then lots of cities do. But it evolves over time. And at some point, the young people moving into that activity, into automotive sort of push back on the stuff that used to be there. Now, in the 90s, Chicago was all Honda Civics, like crazy-tuned Honda Civics. And you would often find, like, a Civic that has an Acura engine in it, and they would do the lowrider thing on those, or the severely canted wheels. And you'd get cheaper guys that would just slap what we used to call fart cans on the back of them, which they would replace the muffler with a very small...
Yeah,
and they were just burbly and loud. But it was a great culture, actually. It was a lot of fun. And that's changed since then. And really big around here now, and I'm sure this is national, is what they call the JDM movement.
Yep.
Which is cars that you can now import from Japan from the 90s. You can start importing those now legally, gray marketing them. So you see those around here. And in fact, there's a dealership on Rand Road, really close to the studio, that sells those.
Huh.
Including, like, the vans.
Okay.
So, really cool stuff.
But, yeah.
All right.
So, Chi-Town Alley, pretty cool.
Later in the show, we're going to talk to Mark Leneve. He's a partner at Franchise Equity Partners. Here's the interesting thing about that. There's a lot going on in the world of dealerships.
Okay.
Including huge acquisitions, trades, stuff like that. Mark's at the center of that, so we're going to talk about that and what that means to consumers, ultimately.
Okay.
Does that mean we're going to pay more because dealers are holding hands more tightly? I don't know. Interesting bit of news. Maybe you saw this. Nissan's got a big push to get back to selling 1 million cars again in the U.S.
Yes.
They hiccuped.
Is that what you're going to call it, a hiccup?
it was a big hiccup, and they mishandled the part shortage, too, the chip shortage.
Mm.
But here's a vehicle that I think there's a market for coming back. The Nissan Xterra. Due back likely as a 2029 model. For people who do not remember the Xterra, it was briefly a huge hit.
Yeah.
But it was a body-on-frame truck, very much like the Toyota 4Runner. And it had real off-road grit. It was kind of cool looking, and people loved it.
Yes.
So they're going to bring this back. We don't know what it's going to look like, how much it's going to actually be a cool body-on-frame truck. Don't know,
but I would anticipate if they're smart, which is debatable sometimes, they will probably make it look very retro and close to the old.
Hopefully.
Fingers
there was
left.
A really cool thing going on the roof, if you remember, where there was a cage that came standard, like the kind of cage you would throw off-road tires on if you were in a rally.
Yeah, you know, and I had a friend who ran an old Xterra in the Rebel Rally last year.
How did that truck do?
I mean, it did okay.
If it held up, it held up.
It held up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Funny that Jim would mention the Cybercab, because in our conversation of Tesla, we did not discuss the Cybercab.
Mm-hmm.
But that vehicle, more or less going into production soon,
yep.
It's going to be built at the Austin factory,
yep.
The Austin Gigafactory. Here's the thing about that. I forgot it in talking about future products coming from Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the anticipated volume is for this thing. And price is going to play a big role, too. But one mm-hmm. of the things that they don't have yet is full autonomous capability. Right? You mentioned there's a couple in Chicago. I didn't know that, but they're going to be with drivers. No, Chicago.
But there's no gas pedal or brake pedal. There is no steering wheel.
There has to be some control because they're bringing ride-alone drivers. So you looked into the car and that stuff wasn't there.
On the show floor, it was not there. And I do not know if the test cars that they have floating around Chicago have those things. I was too focused on like trying to figure out what in the heck, like what in the Tesla it was when I saw it on the roads.
The strangest thing about this, and listener Rich has cautioned me about slamming Tesla. Hey, Rich, but this vehicle is a coupe.
Yeah,
which is
it only has two seats in it too.
Very weird for a cab, but I guess if you get to the point where there is no driver.
Right.
Then you can use both front seats and you have a two-passenger zip-around kind of vehicle. But it seems practically limited by that.
Well, so I was talking to you. There were a couple of product specialists on hand, and I was just like, okay, you got to give me the brief synopsis of this. And the idea is that it will be a personally owned car, like you're buying, you know, a Chevy Tahoe or a, you know, Honda Civic. It's your car. You own it. But it will drive you to and from work. And then while you are at work, you know, the idea is that you could then loan it out as a cab to other people. So you're, you know, 9 to 5 at an office and then you just like set it up to be a Lyft and somebody can hail some random stranger, mind you, can hail your car and then make you money while you are working another job.
This concept feels a decade old. It feels like we talked about ride sharing before the electric car noise started.
Right.
And I don't know that people want other people driving around in their car, even for a little money. So it's weird. And it's interesting, too, because they're not going to sell these to ride-hailing companies?
I mean, he did not say that they, like, he specifically mentioned that it would be a privately owned vehicle.
It's so weird.
Yeah.
It's so weird that that's the Tesla line. So you were talking to a Tesla guy.
Yeah.
That's their take.
That's what that Tesla guy told me.
Yeah, because Uber just wiped out the last of the I-Paces, the Jaguar I-Paces that were lying around anywhere, and they bought mm-hmm. those. It's a very weird car for them to use, but they are crossovers and kind of comfortable, so why not? All right. That's weird.
It's weird and cool, and I was so geeked out that I actually saw it on the road. I have very, very bad photos through a very, like, dirty windshield that you can see a gold blob, and you're like, oh, yeah, that's it.
Does it have, like, disc wheels?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm putting a picture of it in my stories right now, so you can catch it in my stories on Instagram and Facebook.
Yeah, and there are pictures on the Chicago Auto Show Facebook page, too.
Yeah, and I can share the photos I took, and we can post those on our Facebook page.
All right. Interesting story from Reuters, though other outlets are talking about this. One of the ways that Chinese companies might come into the U.S.
Okay.
Easily.
Yeah.
Is simply by tying up with an existing manufacturer. The news here is that Ford and Geely are in talks for a manufacturing technology partnership, which means that Ford's excess capacity could become Geely capacity, which would make it really easy for Geely to start selling cars in the U.S. They could even sell them as Fords.
Mm.
You know, they don't have to sell them as Geely. So, interesting. I don't know how that would be blocked by the federal government if they chose to take issue with that. But there you have it. All right. The Altima sticking around through 2027.
Yes.
All right. That's it. That's all I've got. And my Stelvio review. You and I were going to talk about that car together, I believe.
Yes.
Wasn't that the deal we had with...
Yes.
Our Stellantis friends.
Yeah, and you had the Intensa model too, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep, in Verde Fangio, which is by far the craziest color I've driven in a long time.
Of the name?
Well, what's that guy's name? Juan Manuel Fangio, the race car driver.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was the livery of his race car.
Yeah.
Going way back. So, but it's green.
I thought it was really lovely green.
Oh, I don't know that I'd want that car. There's that beautiful Alfa Rosa, the red.
Mm-hmm.
I want that.
Okay. I like green. You're all wearing right. green today.
Just barely.
Yeah, and that's green.
All right. Just barely.
I'm taking your picture and I'm posting it. That's green.
I'm a little upset by this.
Okay.
I'm not ready for this, but
I know.
You just drove the new Subaru Outback.
Yes.
New for 2026.
Yes.
And here's my problem with it.
I think when you walked in the studio today, you said they ruined it.
Yes.
That's your problem with it.
And that's based entirely on a quick visual take. But it no longer looks like a station wagon.
No, it doesn't.
And that was the charm, I thought, of the Outback, that it was a station wagon that had been beefed up for anything.
Okay.
I love the Outback.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I love the new Outback, but I've always thought my wife and I might buy an Outback.
Okay.
And we are Subaru owners. We're multi-Subaru owners.
Mm-hmm.
We've owned a Forester. She owns a Crosstrek. We believe in the Subaru doctrine. But you are driving the no longer a station wagon.
No longer a station wagon.
Do tell.
You know what? It's funny because I've been posting some pictures out into social media, and I'm getting a little bit of the same feedback that people are very angst-ridden about the fact that it is no longer a wagon. But I think it's really handsome. I think it looks good. It's got more upright stance, more cargo space because of the upright stance. You know, my Rebel partner was in town over the weekend with her husband, and I had like two big boxes in the trunk, their luggage, and everything fit fine. I could have put more back there. So it tells me there's plenty of space back there for a full-on, you know, eight-day road trip with four people and their luggage. And so good cargo space, spare tire. I'm driving the Limited XT trim. It has really nice, I mean, plain black interior, but it's nice. It's functional. People who want to put gear or bikes or whatever in the back, you're not going to scuff it up or get it dirty. So that's nice. The ride and handling is really nice. So this has the 2.4 liter boxer engine, so turbocharged four cylinder, 260 horsepower, 277 pound feet of torque, and it is so peppy. It is so peppy that I am not getting the fuel economy that you should be getting. I think I'm getting 20 miles per gallon, and you should be getting, I want to say 24 in combined driving.
But
I'm not getting
that. But you were moving cargo around, right?
I was moving cargo and people. I had people and things in there.
People weigh a lot.
Well, you know, they sometimes do. I do not, but some people do.
Four people, 750, 800 pounds.
That's true. I mean, my husband is 200 pounds, so he's a big un. But I loved it, and I feel very comfortable in it. Good commanding driving position, comfortable seats. I have very few complaints about it. The technology is good. You've got wireless Apple CarPlay. Instead of that long vertical screen that people hated, they've gone to more of a square, like horizontal screen.
Yeah, for people who don't know, the screen was very much like what's in the RAM.
Yeah.
Actually, that it's vertically oriented and huge.
Yes.
It was huge, and everything was on it.
And it's still huge, but not everything is on it. They've brought back physical buttons. And dials, and so that's a happy thing. There are some versions of the Outback that have hands-free driving. The Limited XT does not. I think it's just the Touring and maybe the Wilderness that have the hands-free driving. So I wasn't able to experience that, but the Adaptive Cruise Control and Lane Keep Assist is really good. And I found that the safety systems are not as annoying as they have been. Like sometimes you drive Subarus and it's like somebody cuts in front of you and it's like, bah, 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 and you like get a little bit close to the line and it's like, bah, 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 and it's
okay,
like barking
never do
at you.
That again.
Sorry. Sorry for those people that I just broke your eardrums, but it does a lot of beeping, in the previous models. And I thought this was a little bit more restrained and, a little bit more, tolerable. So you are more likely to leave the safety systems on.
So interesting stuff. You mentioned the base engine's a 2.5, the upgrade engine's a 2.4 turbo. There are only six trim levels.
Yes.
Now down from nine.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason for that probably is that the hybrid's going to kick in soon.
Yes.
Subaru's got a hybrid version of the 2.5 that's it's in the Outback already and in the, not the Outback, the Crosstrek and the Forester, I believe. So we're going to see that elsewhere. Prices range from $36,445 to a big $49,445 for the Touring XT. So I think that'll be the first non-Ascent They break $50,000 at Subaru.
Yeah,
and, with any stuff.
And the version I'm driving, the Limited XT, is about $45,000. I think it's just more than $45,000 with destination. Yep.
So here's an interesting thing about this. I do not like the fact that it does not look like a wagon, but in terms of product strategy, it probably makes sense. So the Crosstrek, the Forester, and the Outback all sell in big numbers. $192,000, $175,000, $157,000, in that order. After that, things get slow. And the Ascent, their midsize, never discussed midsize crossover, only sells about $44,000.
Yeah.
So I think that they're pushing this up between where the car was and the Ascent.
Yeah.
So that the Forester plays the traditional role of a compact crossover, and this is sort of becoming a midsize crossover.
Yeah.
I think that's what's happening here. It's got the Outback name, so that's gold. So there's the stuff. The hybrid's coming soon. I did check. It looks like the hybrid's coming as a 2027 model.
Okay.
So we will see more models in that lineup as that happens.
And, you know, for people who feel similarly to you, I would say don't just hate it by looking at photos. Like, go spend time with it and see it and drive it. But I mean, like I said,
people should jump to conclusions.
Yeah, no jumping to conclusions. I got a lot of comments on social media of unkind sentiments, and I'm going to say you just need to give it a shot. And once you drive it, like, you may not care what it looks like.
I'm sure that it is actually a very good car. I'm just a little bit hurt.
Okay.
I liked the old Outback.
Well, you know,
since
what?
The beginning.
Change happens. Change happens, and you need to get over it.
Yeah, I guess so. All right. That's on sale now?
Yes.
All right. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we talk to Mark Leneve of Franchise Equity Partners. Stick around.
Questions or comments?
Drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.
That's carstuff@consumerguide.com.
The Chicago Auto Show zooms into McCormick Place this February 7th through the 16th. The cars are certainly the star, but did you know the Chicago Auto Show has indoor test tracks and outdoor test drives? Take a thrilling ride on one of two indoor mountain climbs with either Ford or Jeep and decide who conquers the challenge best. Come experience the latest gas-powered, hybrid, plug-in hybrid, and electric vehicles all in one place. Take a trip into the national parks and adopt a dog with Subaru. Dream about a lavish lifestyle at the Supercar Gallery. Visit returning exhibits, Overlanding Chicago, and the Family Zone, where kids can test drive their own vehicles. Don't miss the new Chi-Town Alley that celebrates Chicago car culture and unites car enthusiasts. Join us for an indoor run, craft beer tasting, auto career day, and so much more. The Chicago Auto Show has something for everyone. February 7th through the 16th at McCormick Place. Find out more and buy tickets today at chicagoautoshow.com.
Welcome back to the Car Stuff Podcast.
And we're back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. I'm Tom. She is Jill. How you doing, Jill?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
You just marveled at the donuts.
I did. They're cherry.
You had winced.
I had winced.
And now you're not wincing.
And now I'm not wincing. This is a childhood favorite. This brings back memories of my dad and going to Dunkin' Donuts after church on Sundays.
Really?
Yeah.
They smell good.
Yeah, this makes me very happy. You've made my day.
The donuts from Spunky Dunkers, the cherries smell good, but those are seasonal, and the blueberries smell fantastic. All right. You ready to talk a little bit about dealerships?
Yes.
Because I am. On the phone with us is Mark Leneve. He's a partner at Franchise Equity Partners. Mark, how are you today?
Technical difficulty.
Well, we will talk to Mark in a moment.
Yes.
I was just talking about my experience at a dealer. I didn't talk about this on an air yet, but my daughter had purchased just weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago, a brand new Mazda CX-30. She had a wreck.
Yeah.
She's fine.
Yes.
Accident was not her fault, but the car was totaled.
I'm like, the car is not fine.
So I want to get back to the story when we have time, but one of the interesting things was in the shopping experience was how the dealership was handling this old 2020-25 content. And it's very weird.
Okay.
So they had four models listed available for sale, all CX-30s, all carbon edition turbos, identical cars with identical options, not very many options. Mazda doesn't really do options. One of them was $3,000 less than the others. We'll talk about that in a moment.
TBD.
Yeah, it's a very weird story. But on the phone with us now is Mark Leneve, partner at Franchise Equity Partners. Mark, how are you today?
I'm doing great. I apologize for that. I was thinking about cherry donuts and it took me off my game.
They look good. I got to tell you what. Mark, you're not going to remember this, but you and I spoke maybe 15 years ago. I interviewed you at the, I think it was the Chicago Auto Show. But no big deal. You were with GM at the time.
Tom, you know, I recognize you and Jill's name. So in all my years, you know, the names stick with me pretty good. So it's a pleasure to be on with you guys.
Well, thanks for joining us. I know you're a busy man. Mark, tell us a little bit about Franchise Equity Partners and what you do there.
It's a really interesting concept. When I retired from Ford, which was in early 2021, the two founding partners, Mike Esposito and Scott Romanoff, they were two very senior Goldman Sachs execs that had retired in 2020. And they had a thesis, wasn't even a company yet, and it was really based out of Mike and his personal portfolio. It had invested in some Jersey Mike sub shops in Boston. And they started thinking about the kind of the franchisee sector of the U.S. economy, car dealerships, fast food restaurants, beer distributorships, health clubs, et cetera. I could go on and on. And they noticed a couple of things. One, there was very little private equity, almost none in auto, a little bit in restaurants, but it hadn't like become rampant like it has in other sectors like banking and insurance and those kinds of things. And that you have these great family, for the most part, family-owned businesses.
Yeah,
parented by great brands like Chevy to Ford to Toyota to Taco Bell to Budweiser to, you know, Molson Coors, et cetera. And they had some natural, strengths in terms of, you know, protected market areas. The OEMs, you know, had a real vested interest in making sure that they were successful. So, you know, they did a lot of research and were able to receive funding on a thesis from a company called HPS out of New York, which has about well over now $200 billion under management, that if we had capital that wasn't traditional private equity, in other words, we weren't trying to do a roll up and then liquidate after 5 or 6 years, you know, to monetize the investment, but we looked more like a family office where we could bring capital that was flexible, that we were passive investors, and that we were permanent, that our money would stay in forever, for as long as the partners wanted it to, that might have some appeal in the franchisee sector. Because OEMs, and I remember when I was running sales and marketing at Ford and GM, I didn't want anything to do with private equity being part of it. I wanted to deal with the families, and you know, I didn't want some bank that I didn't know involved. So, you know, we put together the thesis and received the funding, and the fund is now close to 5 years old. We're over 15 investments, over $1 billion invested. We're starting on our next billion. Three of those 15 are in auto, with the most recent being Roger Penske Jr.'s California platform. Then I'm sure we'll get to that. And it's been a great, you know, kind of post OEM career, job for me, because I could do it from home. I stay involved with dealers. I stay current with the industry, and I'm learning some about some of these other sectors we're involved in. So it's been a lot of fun, and we're getting more and more interest, and we can talk about that, because these car dealerships are becoming so valuable now that it's very difficult to come up with, you know, either debt funding or, you know, just family wealth to afford, to grow. So we think we're hitting the market at a real sweet spot. We were at NADA last week, had a ton of interest. People are starting to really know who we are. The OEMs understand and think that we can help with their objectives. So I'm enjoying it. I feel very blessed that I'm involved.
So Mark, what is driving the increased value of dealerships, right? There are these mega groups now, Lithia, Penske, AutoNation, Group One, and Asbury, these huge groups of dealers. And those are all public, I believe. Is it because they've decided, or the industry in general has determined that dealerships are probably sweet spots for maybe squeezing a little bit more value out of them than there were? People didn't want to get into the business until they realize it's super profitable.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, is, you know, I started in 1981, so, you know, 45 years ago, calling on dealerships. I actually started with Cadillac division in Los Angeles, California. And the model, a lot of retail industries have changed dramatically, or many have just gone away. If you think of, like, bookstores are a good example, but the car dealership model, it's evolved greatly, but it's still consistent with 45 years ago. And why has it had that kind of staying power? Because you've got local entrepreneurs and families vested in the community. They put up, you know, up to date, nice facilities. They attract good people, train them. If you go into a really good dealership, I guarantee you, you'll meet a dozen people that have been there 20 years, 30 years, 40 years.
Okay.
And the dealership's been around from grandfather to father to son. And they take a financial and customer execution burden off of the OEMs with a local touch. And, you know, I was fascinated when Tesla came out. I was at Ford Motor Company as head of sales and marketing when it came out with the direct to consumer model.
Yeah.
And I think to some extent that has its place. But, you know, if you fully get to scale and volume and you have to build out service facilities to take care of all these customers and all these units in operation, I've studied extensively. I don't see where that's more efficient or better for the consumer than having, you know, independent franchise dealers that are monitored and work in conjunction with the OEMs. I just think it's a great model that's stood the test of time.
So when a group acquires a dealership, how does that dealership change? Say you've got, you know, Bob Smith's Buick, and then it's taken over by a larger group. Does much about that business change?
Well, it depends on who the acquirer is and who the dealer is. If you have a dealer retiring, and that's kind of the case right now, where the average age of the U.S. auto dealer has got to be close to 70 years old.
Oh.
And, you know, do they have children coming into the business or don't they? Are they retiring or they want to stay with the business or their people want to stay? And it just depends, Tom, like. When the big public company, say an Auto Nation, buys a store, then they'll come in, they'll retain a lot of the people, but they impose a new system. You know, they run it like a company, you know, where they have very consistent processes across all their couple hundred dealerships or whatever it is that they own, where they'll come in with a new system. And then you go all the way to our case, where we don't want to own a majority position. We'd like to be 49.5% or below. Our number one criteria is we want to align with the best operators. And that's real simple because we're not going to operate. We're investors. We're in the background. We're passive. So we want to align with really good operators. They're going to continue to do a return. We don't get a guaranteed coupon or payment. We go up and down with the performance of the individual dealer. So we're very interested when we make an investment to get to know the operator, his or her key people, really understand the location, the market they're serving, because, you know, we're passive investors and it just depends. So like in our case, very little changes or nothing changes at the dealership. In a case of, say, an acquisition by one of the big public companies, potentially a lot could change.
So if somebody is interested in like creating a dealer franchise, but they need a little help, is that when you step in and help them out? And like, what does that look like? How would somebody reach out to you for investment?
Well, Joe, it's really hard right now with the value of dealerships for an individual investor to come into the business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's unusual. And, you know, because if you're a salesperson or a general manager at a dealership and you're looking to buy a, you know, Chevrolet store that's profitable, I mean, at a minimum, you're going to pay, you know, $5 to $10 million blue sky, even in a small market.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm singling out Chevy. It could be Ford or Honda or any of the major players. And plus there's real estate involved. Now it can be done. And in some cases, we're working with OEMs where they have a promising young general manager that they'd like to become a dealer. And we would provide some of that capital for them to become the owner operator with a buyout over time. And, you know, we're working with several OEMs that are interested in us assisting them in that regard. In fact, we met with several last week at the NADA convention. That's not really our sweet spot, but we'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
Our sweet spot is more, if you have a dealer group has, say, 10 dealerships, and our first two investments were identical to what I'm going to describe, and say those 10 dealerships are worth $100 million, and the dealer wants to buy another group of dealers, say five more, that cost $50 million,
mm-hmm.
but doesn't want to finance the whole thing through debt with a bank,
uh-huh.
We'll come in, we'll write the check for the $50 million, and then re-spread it to end up at roughly 33% of the 15 dealerships. If I'm just giving you real simple math for the way that it worked. And that's more typical the kind of investment we'll do. In Roger Penske's case, he had a partner. He had a partner that that had passed, unfortunately, and the widow wanted to sell her interest. And we provided the capital to take care of the widow's of his former partner's interest, and you know, and then took a piece of each of the stores involved in the Southern California platform. So each situation is a little bit different, but our primary uses are to help a dealer grow, acquire more. We provide the capital to acquire more dealerships, to take out a disinterested investor or a family member or, you know, somebody that's owns an equity stake in the dealership but doesn't really, you know, want to be involved anymore. You've got those two, or to help a dealer really just take chips off the table where, you know, hey, look, I've worked my whole life. I own these 10 dealerships are worth $100 million. I'd like to sell 25% and take $25 million off the table and invest in other things or build a hospital or whatever they may want to do. And we've talked to people and made investments in all those areas. So it's exciting and a lot of fun.
So, Mark, you mentioned something interesting earlier. After Jill's question, you suggested that it's not common for people to get into the business anymore just because it's expensive and perhaps the number of franchises is capped by manufacturers. So this is my question. Is there really just a finite number of dealerships now and there's not really going to be more?
Well, Tom, everybody, for the most part, well, certainly GM, Ford, and Chrysler have been consolidating for 30 years.
We saw that with Cadillac, yeah.
You know, when I started at GM, we probably had 6,000 dealerships, and by the time I left in 2009, it was probably more like 3,500.
Wow.
I'm close on those numbers. Because scale, the thing is scale matters. So if you've got one dealership, if you're a single owner in one dealership, and there's plenty of those around the country that do a terrific job, and you're in a major market, if you're competing with other dealers that own 5, 6, 7, 8 dealerships, it's difficult because the scale operators first of all, they can roll up their ad budgets and the internet departments, which is a big deal. They can make those all common, you know, and say what we call back office to the 5 or 6 stores. They've got career pathing where they can take, you know, their talented young employees and move them from salesperson at one place to sales manager at another place, to general manager at another place. And they get some diversity usually across brands. They own several different kinds of brands. So as you guys know from following the industry, not every brand's strong every year. You know, there's cycles, some are down with the product cycle, it comes back, et cetera. So there are scale advantages. A really good operator that owns one store will always have a place in the business, but they are becoming fewer and fewer of those as you know, the public companies and the big dealer operators continue to roll up. And we're part of that process. We provide capital to help that process.
Mark, we're running out of time, but I do have a question for you. You had mentioned that you guys are quiet partners, silent partners, and that you take up to half or just under half. Does that mean that you really acquire only like dealerships or dealership groups that you find to be in really good shape? Essentially, you don't buy into fixer-uppers?
Correct, Tom. That's a really good question because, like I said, we don't operate. Now, we have an analytics department. We have a data science department. You've got myself and several other partners that have automotive experience where we can certainly help out, and we have, but we don't operate. So we align with really good operators. However, once we're partnered with them, we do like to go out and buy fixer uppers together. So our very first investments, the Georgica Auto Group in the Northeast, that kind of goes from Philadelphia up through Danbury, Connecticut, and 17 rooftops, I believe, altogether. Since we formed that partnership 4 years ago, we've bought 6 additional stores together, and we buy it at our pro rated portion. So that roughly, when we buy a new store, John Sobel, the dealer operator, buys 60%, and we buy 40%. But they have all been, for the most part, fixer uppers, or at least stores where we thought we could improve the overall performance and sales and profitability and customer satisfaction. So we love to spend you know, the profitability of the dealership on growth rather than just distributions. We find that very exciting and very good model for our business.
Really cool. Mark, we are flat out of time. Tell people how they can find out more about FEP.
We have a website, Franchise Equity Partners, and it is, you can just Google it and find information. And, you know, like I said, it'll provide information on how to get a hold of us and, you know, our basic thesis of our company and, and how to get it. And then you can certainly get a hold of me. My work email is complicated. My, you can reach me. It's real easy. It's my name, Mark Lanave, MarkLaneve at iCloud.com. Get a hold of me, and I promise you I'll get back to you.
We will share that in our show notes. Mark, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure speaking with you all. Thank you.
Thank you. That was Mark Lanave with FEP. We're going to take a break, and when we come back...
Quiz time.
Questions or comments?
Drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.
That's carstuff@consumerguide.com.
The Chicago Auto Show zooms into McCormick Place February 7th through 16th. The cars are certainly the star, but did you know the Chicago Auto Show offers special events, such as the Miles Per Hour Run and a local craft beer sampling event? Experience indoor test tracks, outdoor ride and drives on city streets, and the brand new Chi-Town Alley Auto Enthusiast Area. The 2026 event features something for everyone. The Chicago Auto Show, February 7th through the 16th at McCormick Place. Buy your tickets today at chicagoautoshow.com.
Hi, it's Brendan from Sons of Speed. You've heard me and my colleague Paul on the Car Stuff podcast whenever Jill's out of town. But now you can hear us every week on the We Are Motor Driven podcast, along with Jennifer from Auto Exotica and Harvey from Rides and Drives. We talk about everything from sports cars to trucks to EVs and our favorite, speed. So join us each week by searching We Are Motor Driven wherever you get your favorite podcast.
Welcome back to the Car Stuff Podcast.
And we are back. This is the Consumer Guide Car Stuff Podcast. I'm Tom. She is Jill. I love stuff like that.
You know, it's just kind
it's
of interesting
a little geeky.
To like get a peek behind the curtain.
Yeah. And you have this group. It's not even a dealer group. It's a group investing in dealer groups. Mm-hmm. And it's helping them in some ways consolidate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an outside force driving, even additionally driving this consolidation. Because he mentioned the average dealer is like 70 years old now, the average dealer principal. And I think that increasingly, the family is not interested anymore.
Mm.
I think that these groups that have been in families since the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, these really old legacy franchises, I think the youngsters not so interested.
Mm.
I think.
Maybe.
And if they want to get out, you know,
here's an out.
Here's some money.
Yeah.
Go away.
Bye.
All right. You probably want to talk a little bit about social media.
Just a little bit. Yeah. So I'm on social media, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Threads, Blue Sky, all the things. You can find me at Jill Simonello. And I use the hashtag Car Du Jour. So D-U-J-O-U-R. Yes, that's French. I feel the need to spell it out because I guess for me, like I like soup du jour, soup of the day. And so it just made logical sense because I drive different cars every day to call it car du jour. And people are like, what's du jour?
I don't think I've seen a menu with soup du jour on it in 20 years.
I must be going to different restaurants than you do.
I remember it was a really big deal.
Right?
When I was a kid, my parents and my grandmother, they'd go to a lot of small restaurants. And that was like a thing. It was like the first thing. And of course, you had to ask.
Mm-hmm. What is your soup du jour?
And it was always matzo ball.
So
now you know what side of the city we were on.
Right. Well, so I have to say one of my favorite restaurants in Chicago is Alps Pancake House. It's in the Irving Park neighborhood.
Yeah.
And on Saturdays, they have the best lentil soup.
Yeah.
And I was there yesterday and I was like, what's your soup today? And they're like, well, it's chicken and wild rice. And I was like,
You've been in Chicago a long time. Do you remember the Alps West? It was further west on Irving Park. It was called the Alps West.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I remember that. I don't know if I've ever been to the Alps. I feel like I should have sobered up there at some point.
I don't know how
Wasn't
long it
is. Wasn't it 24 hours or was it
no,
once?
No. It's only open, at least now it's only open until like 2. It's just a breakfast place.
Oh.
And, but it's like at the corner of Irving Park and Elston and is it Monticello maybe? I don't know. But it's at a 6 corner area. But yeah, lentil soup. the soup du jour.
Is there still the salt and pepper diner down there?
No.
Oh, that was hippie. That was hipster.
Yeah, well, I think a couple of the waitresses opened a new restaurant called Salt.
Oh.
And I've been there, and that's right off of Oz Park in Lincoln Park area. I want to say it's called Salt.
Oh, I'm tired of single names, single syllable.
It's a good breakfast place.
Yeah. How many restaurants are called Fork? There's like 90
of
them.
Or Spoon.
Spoon. Yeah.
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 Huh.
All right, it's quiz time.
Okay.
Wait, did you get through that stuff?
Yes, Jill Simonello, Car du Jour. That was okay. The whole car du jour.
And I am Car Guy Tom on Blue Sky and
Twitter.
Thank you.
Yeah, I got
Twitter
you.
X. All right, it's quiz time. I got a topic for you here that I'm sure you're going to love.
Which means I'm going to hate it.
Was it a pickup truck?
Okay.
Going to give you five models.
Okay.
You have to tell me if it's fake or not.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'm ready, and I'm going to eat my cherry donut.
I think you know the first one. The Chevrolet Love, L-U-V. Chevrolet Love. Was it a real pickup truck?
I feel like we've talked about it, and I promptly forgot all about it. I'm going to say yes.
It was, yeah. Available between 1972 and 1982, the Love light utility vehicle was built for Chevrolet by Isuzu.
Okay.
It was one of the first really high-volume small pickup trucks sold in the U.S.,
okay.
I think they were pretty good, too. All right, you've got one.
Woo!
The Ford Sprinter.
Well, I know you had the Dodge Sprinter and the Mercedes Sprinter, and those were both vans.
And a Freightliner Sprinter. For a little while.
I feel like you're putting this in here to throw me off, and the answer is probably yes, but I'm going to say no.
No.
Oh! Woohoo!
All right, you're on the board. Yeah, there was no Ford Sprinter.
I got two!
All right. The Mercury M100 pickup truck. Real or fake?
Did Mercury have a pickup truck? So, I didn't take a picture of it, but yesterday in the Alps parking lot, there was...
Where else?
Where else? There was an old Mazda, was it like B200 pickup truck?
Yeah, the B-Series trucks.
Yep.
They were on for a long time. The end of the B-Series, the last generation, were all Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
Just
mm-hmm.
rebadged.
Yep.
Funny story about that.
Mm-hmm.
The Ranger was available in a lot of configurations. An extended cab, a regular cab, long bed, a short bed,
mm-hmm.
three different engines,
mm-hmm.
two transmissions and a bunch of colors, and then trim levels.
Mm-hmm.
Mazda dealers had no idea what to do with this.
Right.
Mazda, when they sold pickups earlier, far fewer configurations. So they didn't know how to order, you know, and they had no idea what people in their area would want because they'd never had this kind of choice before. Kind of messed with the dealers.
Yeah.
There was too much available.
Yep. Okay.
Mercury M100.
I don't know if Mercury had a pickup truck. I'm going to say no.
Yes.
Ugh.
It's a bit of a trick question. It was a Canadian product.
Okay.
And we've talked about Canadian dealership situations before, but
okay.
usually because there were fewer dealers spread out more,
mm-hmm.
they often took on a high-end or low-end product line mm-hmm. thing to kind of compensate for the lack of dealership representation. Anyway, Mercury dealers started selling pickup trucks in Canada, the M100, between 1948 and 1968.
Hmm.
And I once saw at Superdog, Chicago's legendary Superdog, I saw an M100.
Okay.
It was beautiful. It was black. And it's funny because they look just like F-Series pickups,
okay.
but with more chrome, which was totally unnecessary.
Yeah.
So you got that one wrong.
I did.
All right.
I got two.
All right. The Isuzu Hombre.
H-O-M-B-R-E.
H-O-M-B-R-E.
Hombre.
Yes, that.
Hombre. Isuzu?
Isuzu.
Hombre. Not to be confused with hombre, which is a hair thing.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Women, when you like kind of like gradually lighten the tips of your hair, that's hombre.
Okay.
O-M-B-R-E.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right.
I
just forgot that.
No, just like I don't know if the Isuzu Hombre is a truck or not. I'm going to say yes.
It was.
Huh?
Between 1996 and 2000 in the U.S., it was just a rebadged Chevy S10
okay.
pickup. All right, so you've got three of four. You've already won the Nissan Hardbody.
That sounds like something they would do.
Nissan Hardbody.
Like, not a name, but yes, I'm going to say yes.
It kind of wasn't a name, I think. They advertised it as the Hardbody,
mm-hmm.
but I think maybe it might have just been called Nissan Pickup.
Okay.
But it was available between 1985 and 1997, and they absolutely called it that. It's advertising.
Okay. So right. I was right. So I got 4 out of 5.
The hard bodies. The hard bodies kind of a cool modular look.
Okay.
You would recognize it if you saw it, but maybe didn't know it was called the hard body. All right. Bonus question.
Right. And I just have to say, if I had not gotten the ones that I had gotten, my previous coworker, Tim Estradol from Pickup Truck Plus SUV Talk, would have been very upset.
Probably. Probably. All right. You're into cooking.
I am, actually.
You're into cooking. I have a cooking question for you here. Mm-hmm. Do you cook Chinese much?
We do like stir-fry Sundays occasionally.
Stir-fry Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
This might come up then. Are you ready?
Okay.
Which of the following is not typically one of the elements of Chinese five-spice blends?
Ooh, okay.
Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Star anise,
mm-hmm.
anise, white pepper, cinnamon, Sichuan pepper, or fennel seeds? One of those not.
I think it's the pepper.
The white pepper?
No. What, the Sichuan?
Yeah.
That one.
The Sichuan pepper, you think that's not part of it?
Yeah.
It is.
Ugh.
Yeah, white pepper is the fake.
Okay.
Cloves would be the fifth thing.
Yeah, so like, because I actually have five spice at home, and I remember thinking it would be like a spicy five spice thing, and then I was like, wait a minute, this has anise and cinnamon and like cloves. It's a weird
total cheat if you want something to taste Chinese.
Yeah.
Just buy a jar of this and just plop it on anything.
But it was
Chinese waffles. Just sprinkle this on. Yeah.
But I thought it was weird because there are things that I would associate with as sweet that are in this, and I would have thought it would have been completely spicy. But
yeah. So star anise, cloves, cinnamon, Sichuan pepper, and fennel seeds.
Okay. So the white pepper was the fake.
Yep.
All right.
There we go.
Okay.
A couple of things I wanted to talk about. I want to talk about this car buying thing.
Yeah, I was like, we got to get back to your to be continued.
So we have a couple of minutes here. My daughter and I Thursday went to a dealership. They advertised 4 versions of the exact car she had, but 1 year newer.
Okay, so she bought a 2024?
She had a 2024. That got wrecked.
Yeah.
Now we're looking at 2025s.
Okay.
And they had 4 2025 exactly this car. It's been discontinued. That's mm-hmm. the CX-30 Carbon Edition Turbo.
Right.
That's gone. There's something replaced called the Air Edition.
Okay.
Decidedly more feminine. It's got a white and blue interior, but it is a turbo.
Okay.
So the turbos are at the premium end of the lineup, mm-hmm. obviously. So they advertised 4 of these vehicles. 3 of them were listed for $31,495.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was listed for $28,495.
Mm-hmm.
The one at $28,495 had 15 miles on it. So I'm texting them, and I'm like, what? And I want to be sure, because why is this $3,000 less?
Right, with 15 miles on it.
Is there no dashboard? Does it only have 3 wheels? Like, what is wrong?
Has it already been in an accident?
With this car. And for whatever reason, the people I spoke to on the phone and that I was texting didn't seem to understand my...
The question?
Yeah. they're like, well, yeah, that's it. Why are you asking questions? I'm like, because it's $3,000 less.
Yeah.
So we go to the store.
Uh-huh.
It's there.
Uh-huh.
We test drive it. It doesn't seem like there had been a bad fire in it or anything.
Okay.
We come back, and I get the Carfax. I'm asking questions like, this car was never in a wreck. It's perfectly cool. Here's the story, and I guess I believe it. This dealership puts a lot of cars into their loaner fleet.
Okay.
Those become what they call, loaners, they sell them for less.
Something happens to somebody's car, they loan that out.
Yeah, so this one never got used.
Okay.
They put it in the loaner fleet, they never used it,
uh-huh.
and now it's a used car.
Okay.
And it's part of the way they write off the taxes and the way Mazda reimburses for loaners, mm-hmm. and it was just this really weird anomaly that they never used. And I'm like, and I can have this? Like
For $28,000, I can have this.
Yeah, like $3,000 less than the other cars. And the weird thing is it's now certified pre-owned,
mm-hmm.
which means that at 15 miles, they change the oil.
Mm-hmm. Well, they need to do that at 15 miles.
They need to do it if they call it certified pre-owned as part of that deal.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, I mean, this all worked out spectacularly well for us. But I guess the moral of the story is, like, if you have time, just do a lot of shopping.
Yeah.
Just to figure out what, because this wasn't me being a crafty buyer. This was me stumbling onto this crazy deal
yeah.
that was real for some reason. I still feel like there's like something surprising here, like the back seat.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And you've got the trunk monkey in the back or something like that who's going to hit people over the head with a crowbar. You know what my takeaway of this is? Your daughter liked the CX-30 enough that she bought another one.
Yeah. No, she loves the car.
I love the car.
It's secretly,
so I'm glad she liked it.
It's secretly very, very fast for one thing. That 2.5 turbo was crazy. But it's also really well screwed together. And the interior, when a lot of reviewers compare these vehicles to other cars, they compare them to things like the BMW X1 or the Mini Countryman.
Mm-hmm.
That's because the interior is so nice. Real leather, screwed together nicely. Everything's great about it. And she got super used to the weird center knob thing right away.
Okay.
Not an issue.
The touch controller, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the question of the day.
Uh-huh.
Did she get a color that she likes better?
That is only offered in one color.
Okay.
It's a weird clay. I think they call it mica sand, or
okay.
zircon.
Okay, so it's the same color?
It's the same color. So there was only one color for the carbon edition.
Okay.
So... the carbon edition was weird anyway because it was a kind of sporty entry-level turbo in the middle of their lineup.
Mm-hmm.
It was the cheapest way to get into a turbo. They've gotten rid of it now, and there's something replacing it called the Air Edition.
Okay.
Did I say this on air? I don't think I did.
I think you did.
It's very feminine.
With a blue and white interior.
Blue and white interior, and that's the only interior, but you do get the turbo. Otherwise, you have to step up to the premium whatever top trim level.
Okay.
Which is 40 grand.
Mm.
It's a lot of money for...
a compact.
For a subcompact crossover, but they're really great cars, standard all-wheel drive. So that's the deal. I'd like to take credit for this, but absolutely fell into it. I was just poking around on their website. And
I would say the other moral of this story is if you're looking for a new car and you're looking for a deal, apparently go buy a Mazda CX-30.
You know what else? This is the slow time of the year sales-wise. Mm. January, February, March. It's not sales don't pick up until people start to get their income tax.
Right.
Returns.
Okay.
And then all of a sudden they have a down payment.
Right.
That's when sales start to pick up and then you get into summer and summer is a hot sales season. So this is a good time to buy a car anyway because dealers aren't moving a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If there are leftover 2025s, they're keen to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good time to go look for a car right now.
Right now.
Yeah. I know a lot of people rush at the end of the year. Don't do that.
Hmm.
Well, you can, right? Because you have the end of the month thing. That is actually a real thing. Salesmen do try to cram in more stuff at the last minute. So there you have it. That's my sales story.
Okay.
All right. That's all I got.
I like it. It's a good story.
Guess what we did?
We had an amazing show, as always.
Good show. Thank you to Mark Leneve of FEP.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
Thank you to producer Randy and the good folks here at TalkZone.
Mm.
Let's talk more about cars again.
Next week.
Remember to check us out at consumerguide.com.
The Car Stuff Podcast is produced by J-Turn Media.
To advertise on the show, please drop us a line at carstuff@consumerguide.com.